O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike my enemies on the cheek, you break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord, your blessing be on all your people. All right, a little bit of a quiz. This passage is found in the Gospel of Mark, the book of Leviticus, 2 Hezekiah, 1 Hezekiah, Psalms. Very good. See how intelligent we are here. All right, and now for the all-expense trip to Zanesville, Indiana, which psalm would this be? How do you know that?
You've been following when you left off.
There you go. It's a logical sequence. All right, I mentioned Psalm 3. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that we would be actually starting our next series today from a book in the Bible, and so this is it, the book of Psalms. When we did Psalms 1 and 2 a while back, I wasn't at the point of, you know, making a commitment to such a series, but now I am. We have 150 of these, and so this series will take could take several years to work through, probably decades at my rate, and this is why our church will never be 8,000. It could, but it won't, because I don't plan to go through all 150 psalms in this particular series. You may remember, let's go back, sorry. I had a picture of Asia Noreen, so there she is. You may remember from previous discussions that the psalms are a collection of five different books. Our focus in this series will be on those psalms that belong to book one, so 1 through 41. And then we'll take a break, and somewhere along the way, a few years from now or so, we'll pick it up again with book two. And my successor can work in books three and four in his sermon plan as he sees fit. And his successor, book five, and his successor can start from the beginning again. Okay. So the official title of our current series is The First Book of Psalms. How do you like that? Isn't that catchy and clever? Can you remember that? First Book of Psalms. All right, now I've had a good 2 months to, you know, really think about how I'm going to do this series. And as of this morning, I still don't know. I probably won't know until we are a few weeks into it. So let me just kind of run by some of the options for you that I'm considering. We would have the traditional method, and that would be work through every one of the 41 Psalms, one per Sunday. The disadvantage here is that this could take quite a while and be a bit overwhelming. And when you're in the Psalms a long time, you know, they all kind of start sounding the same. It gets kind of a little thick. And many of the Psalms in Book 1 are what we call laments. You may remember that. David complains about a particular problem he's facing. He calls out to God for help. Sometimes he complains that God is not responding fast enough. However, the Psalm ends on a note of trusting in God. And such Psalms are certainly worthy of our attention, but week after week of that could get a little wearisome. However, we would most certainly work in some breaks in this, so it would be doable. We got holidays, guest speakers, Lord's Supper services. I have a 12-week vacation coming up soon, so we'd get a good break from that then. And you can do this sort of thing with the Psalms because each one is its own unit. Psalm 23, for instance, doesn't require us to follow the author's train of thought from Psalm 22. Basically, we can start and stop whenever we want to. And so, you know, when nothing else is scheduled or nothing else is pressing, we can just fall back on our ongoing study of the Psalms, picking it up where we left off. So that's one option. Another option would be to cherry pick. Instead of working through every one of the 41 Psalms, I could just pick a few of the favorites. In fact, during my study break, I tried to make a top 10 list several times. The problem was I kept coming up with anywhere from 25 to 35 from just book one that I believed warranted attention. It just became hard to eliminate them. But given that some are similar, this would be something we could consider. A third option, one that I've received positive feedback on whenever I've shared the idea with others, is to start the series off working through each of the Psalms in Book 1, helping us get a feel for how they are to be read and understood and applied. And then at some point, like maybe at the beginning of next year, end that sermon series, but continue on with the study itself. And we would do this by adding a spot for a contemplative psalm, you might say, in our order of service, where we'd give it maybe 5 or 10 minutes. It'd be similar to what we do with the contemplative hymn. Someone with the from the congregation would come up, share a few thoughts about the psalm selected for that morning, and then we'd all read it together out loud. So I like that idea a lot. There are some logistical things to work out with it, but I think it could work. And with this, we would not limit it to just the Psalms in Book 1, but we'd probably go through all 150 of them. So I keep going round and round on these options, still haven't been able to settle on one yet. I think we just have to kind of dive in and see how it goes. Today, Psalm 3. Next week, Psalm 4. The week after that, Psalm 5. The week after that,
vacation.
Almost, the Markle picnic. So, all right. Then vacation. All right, a fourth option is just, which I flirted with, was just to abandon the whole idea and start that series on the Song of Solomon that I promised back in January, which I've actually have been working on, but the fact is I spent a lot of money on resources and commentaries, and I've got to get my money's worth out of those. So, but Song of Solomon is definitely in the works. In fact, understanding Psalms will actually, will help us navigate our way through the Song of Solomon, because both are examples of ancient Hebrew poetry. Now, while we're on that note, let me just mention that there are several compelling reasons for taking on the Psalms, and that is why I haven't abandoned the idea, though I've been tempted to do that. For the sake of time, let me just highlight three for this morning. When the New Testament quotes from the Old Testament, it quotes more from the Psalms than from any other book. And that itself says something. If nothing else, that itself would be a reason to become familiar with the Psalms. Secondly, these Psalms have served as the hymnal and prayer book for God's people for centuries, for the Hebrews and for the early Christians. It was the hymnal and prayer book that Jesus used and the first century church. Now, they certainly used other songs as well. The early church used songs about Jesus that are not in the Psalms, but the Psalter was the one that was stuck in the pews, you might say. And these are the songs and prayers that God ordained to be included in his written word, and they have been widely used all over the world in every generation since. And thirdly, poetry occupies a large chunk of the Bible. It just seems irresponsible to skip over this type of literature and not give it the attention that it warrants. The fact that it is poetry actually kind of intimidates me. It's, a little bit out of my element, not something that I'm naturally comfortable with, especially when it comes to teaching it. But given how much of the Bible is poetry, well, again, it would seem to be a disservice to our study of God's Word if we don't at some point take it on. And the whole book of Psalms, the book of Proverbs, the whole book of Job, Song of Solomon, most of Ecclesiastes, and most of the writings of the prophets are poetry. And there are even sections of the historical books in the Old Testament that are poetry. And, it's one thing to read poetry from the Bible occasionally. It's another thing to actually dig into it, learn how to properly understand and apply it. And this is one of the major reasons for this series. There are special guidelines we need to be aware of, special tools involved, you might say, because typically we tend to use the same methods of interpretation that we use when we read the Gospels or the letters of Paul, for instance. But as we will see, that could actually get us into quite a bit of trouble. And I would guess, from my observations, that when it comes to misunderstanding or misapplying something in God's Word, at least half the time it's going to involve one of the Psalms. So these are some of the reasons, main reasons why, compelled to go through this series. Now, typically when we get ready to work through a book of the Bible, I like to take a couple Sundays and go over background information, the who, what, when, where, and why of the book, and note the style of writing, the structure, and those sorts of things. And this kind of information is no less important for the Psalms. In fact, there's actually a lot that needs to be said in way of preparing us to properly approach them. However, this time I've decided to share those kinds of things along the way, a little bit at a time, rather than just dropping everything on us at once. And In fact, I've kind of already been doing this a little bit, our treatment of Psalms 1 and 2, and even our discussion on the imprecatory prayers found in the Psalms that we went through back in March. You know, that included, those teachings included a lot of background and introductory material on the Psalms, and some of that, of course, I'll be repeating in the coming weeks as needed. So basically, my plan at this point is to take a few minutes in each sermon, go over some features about the Psalms in general, how they have been used throughout history, the different types of Psalms, the time period in which they were written, navigating through figures of speech and parallelisms, how to appreciate the images that are used, and of course, some general rules of hermeneutics. So on this note of introduction, let me start off with some challenges that we do face when working through a psalm. And there are many, but I have three that I want to go through this morning. First, and this is the big one, is that we are, of course, here dealing with poetry. And not just poetry, but ancient poetry, ancient Hebrew poetry. And poetry, of course, has many advantages. It appeals more directly to the whole person than standard prose. It stimulates our imaginations. It arouses our emotions. Though it's more difficult to interpret, poetry does capture our attention and is even quite attractive to read, especially to read out loud or to sing. And indeed, this is what poetry is designed for. But poetry has limits, and this will be a challenge. For instance, it is not the best vehicle for teaching us the finer theological truths of the faith, nor is it that well suited to provide a detailed report of past historical events, or to pound into us warnings about destructive sins, like sexual immorality. You know, these are not the sorts of things that the Psalms were designed for. There will be a time when a verse will read like a commandment. It certainly looks like a commandment, but the Psalms are not to be understood as commands. Other times a verse will read like a promise, but the Psalms really are not promises, even though they have that feel to them often. The primary purpose of poetry is not really to teach, but to help us express what we feel. We must remember that the Psalms are the prayers and songs of praise of ancient Israel. They are to God, and they need to be, you know, processed as such. Even when truths are asserted, as in declaring some truth about God, like his faithfulness, for instance, even in these verses, we must understand that the psalmist is simply offering his own observations and or drawing upon what he knows to be true from other scriptures. And so this leads us to the second point or second challenge. You know, most of scripture speaks to us. The Psalms, however, are intended to speak for us. We always kind of have to have that in our thinking when we approach them. Knowing how to express ourselves to God is incredibly important. And therefore, the Psalms are a genuine gift from God to be cherished. They can be quite therapeutic to read, to sing, to pray. We can connect with them in expressing our emotions, both good ones and ones that need some restraint. No matter how sad you are, there is a psalm to help you express that. And the same is true with joy and thanksgiving and sorrow and frustration and anger. And as we talked before about this inward cry for justice. And so again, to have such a collection, 150 of these, that we can use to speak for us, both privately and corporately, is a huge blessing. And thirdly, because psalms are poetry and because they are songs and prayers, we must keep in mind that they are primarily driven by emotion. This means that following the author's train of thought from one verse to the next is not as important as following what he feels. And so in trying to appreciate Psalm 3, for instance, our first task is to determine the intended mood, which informs our understanding of why David, for instance, says what he says and why he says it the way that he says it. Poetry is intensely emotional, and we need to kind of know what the emotion is behind those words. What connects one verse to the next will much of the time be something like joy, praise, gratitude, remorse, despair, anger, grief, frustration, fear, and so on. And on top of that, what the psalmist says will, you know, utilize figures of speech that we are not familiar with today that are intended to highlight that emotion. But all the words of the psalm come together to present a particular message, a message that is designed to stimulate the inner parts or the deeper parts of our inner being. To feel what the psalmist feels, to climb inside his skin, that's, you know, is going to be a bit of a challenge. But without that, the psalm falls flat. All right, on the plus side of this, because the psalms are not intended to be precise theological instruction, you know, technical and heady, they will be easy enough for everyone to follow and even relate to. For each psalm, its central message is pretty simple. It will more or less come down to something like trust God, or thank God, or praise God, or obey God. Just about always it's going to land on something like that. And these are truths that, you know, need to be beaten into us all the time. And poetry can be effective with this as well. And so one thing you can expect to be a little bit different in our study of the Psalms compared to when we study a book of the New Testament, for instance, is that there will not be as much attention given to every word of every line of every verse. Instead, we'll be focusing primarily on the progression of the Psalms' key points. Okay? Everyone following me so far? At this point, how many are looking forward to this study? How many are dreading this study? Okay, all right. One or two, okay. This is, again, a reason why we will never be a church of 8,000. All right. Enough of the introductory comments for today. Let's look at Psalm 3, and let's turn there if you haven't already. The subtitle reads, A Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom, his son. So, kind of try to read this with a little bit a sense of the emotion that is intended here. Psalm 3. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising up against me. Many are saying in my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. All right, a number of different titles for this psalm have been suggested. Quietness amid troubles. Save me, O God. The dark hour, a prayer for help, and confidence in troubled times. The flow of thought here is easy enough to follow. David begins with a lament, a fearful concern about the growing threat of his enemies. Many are rising up against me. He affirms God's willingness to save him, referring to the Lord as a protective shield. He recalls in verse 4 God's faithfulness in the past. He has a history of hearing and answering David's prayers. And because of this, he has peace. In the midst of this great threat, he is able to lie down and sleep. David then, in verse 7, presents to God his actual need, save me. And the psalm then concludes with an affirmation of hope, gratitude, and trust. From the Lord comes deliverance. The prayer serves as a model for us when facing certain threats of hardship, whatever they might be. Not only can we identify with the words of David here, but pray as he prayed, you know, along the same lines. You know, I have a problem. It's pretty major. You are able to take care of it. Knowing this, I will rest in you. Please deliver me. And I will hope in that deliverance and be grateful for it. As we can see here, the first verse sets the tone for all that follows. David is stressed out over the multitude of enemies who are rising up against him. There are different words in the Hebrew to describe an enemy. The most common one conveys the idea of being hated by such a person. This one here is a different word and conveys more of the idea of being oppressed, that of being beaten down under one's boot. It refers to something one encounters in hand-to-hand combat, in the heat of battle, where the enemy gains the upper hand, cutting off all means of escape, preparing for the final kill, that sense of hopelessness. In this case, David stands alone against such an enemy, an army that without question has the upper hand. It is not only numerous, but is constantly multiplying. In fact, his enemies are so confident that their plan to kill David will succeed that they boast there is no salvation for him in God. This could be referring to their belief that David's doom is so sure that even God himself would be helpless to save him. Or it could be that they believe God has deserted David and is unwilling to come to his rescue, perhaps because of his sin with Bathsheba. Either way, the situation is grave, and their cry is intended to shake him to his very bones, to leave him in a state of panic, vulnerable and without hope. God will not deliver him. And so this is how the psalm begins, on this dark note of desperation. It is one we can all identify with, at least to some degree. Maybe not an army, but some other grave threat overwhelms us, leaving us feeling helpless, somewhat like the relentless coils of a boa constrictor drawing tighter and tighter. I'm sure we've all felt that. No way out, no hope in sight. All you can see is utter doom. And I think a lot of us are feeling this way about the times we're currently living in. You know, those who subscribe to biblical Christianity, there's the enemies are multiplying. There's no shortage of them, more every day. And they're getting more hostile. And there doesn't appear to be much hope in sight. But it's not yet to the point that, you know, that David was experiencing this. And instead of melting down in fear and growing hysterical in a panic attack, David, you know, he gathers himself together. He reflects upon his situation. He agrees with the facts. This is hopeless. But then responds with, But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, the glory and the lifter of my head. Everything turns there at the beginning of verse 3. This impending destruction, well, it is something to be feared. But you, O God, can protect me from it. Like a shield, you can come between me and it and provide a barrier of defense. In the first two verses, David presents this hopeless situation to God. In the remaining six verses, he essentially affirms God's goodness and ability to save. The psalm then is essentially a song of trust, highlighted by David's ability to rest in God. In spite of the insurmountable threat, David can do the impossible. And he can lie down and go to sleep. I mean, what a picture of peace and rest. It is the complete antithesis of anxiety and fear. One could imagine asking David, how can anyone sleep at a time like this? To which he would answer, to paraphrase verse 6, I'm not afraid of my enemies, even if they were to number in the tens of thousands, even if they were to surround me, even if they were determined to kill me. If God is for me, who can be against me? Note all that David says about God in expressing his faith in God in this psalm. He rests in who God is, what God has done, and what God can do. Verse 3, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me. Verse 4, he answered me from his holy hill. Verse 5, the Lord sustained me. Verse 7, you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Verse 8, salvation belongs to the Lord. You know, all through it, there is this affirmation of trust. Now, regarding this reference to God striking the enemy's cheek and breaking his teeth, this, of course, is something modern Christians have a difficult time with. It seems rather harsh for a living God to be calling out to him to do. And this is indeed an example of an imprecatory prayer. And so we're not going to go over all that again. We discussed this back in March, and if you missed it, it's on our website. We'd recommend that you go back and revisit that. The cry here in particular, however, with that particular phrase, is probably not so much that of vengeance or inflicting suffering, but of really more of escape and deliverance. And this could be a figure of speech, actually, here. The enemies are like wild animals, and the jaw with its aggressive teeth would, of course, be the weapon of attack. And my notes are out of order. And David here is essentially calling upon God to disable the enemy, to deliver him from their threat. All right, by way of observation, we should note the placement of this psalm, which a number of scholars believe was intentional. As you will remember, Psalm 1 and 2 each emphasize God's sovereignty over our lives and promise blessing to those who yield to his ways. They each go about that quite differently, but the message is very clear in both, and it sets the tone for all the psalms that follow. You know, there is much hardship in life. Threats to our well-being will come. At times, things will be dark, and we'll feel trapped, desperate for a way out, desperate for deliverance. Psalms 1 and 2 provide us with the assurance of God's love and power, of His desire to help and ability to help. You remember some of these expressions. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. He is like a tree planted by streams of water. The Lord watches over the way of the righteous. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. You know, these are tremendous words of encouragement and comfort in Psalms 1 and 2. And this message of God's love and sovereignty that he desires to help and is able to help, for he rules over all, informs our reading of Psalm 3. And for that matter, sheds light on Psalms 4, 5, and 6 as well. All of which describe David crying out to God for deliverance from some impending threat. Indeed, as stated earlier, we find quite a number of psalms like that in Book 1, what we call laments. And so Psalms 1 and 2 serve as the perfect introduction. They set the theological foundation by which one faces hopeless situations. Don't melt down in fear. Don't let anxiety drive you crazy. There is a God, and He is there. And this is exactly what David anchors his hope on here in Psalm 3. Many are rising up against me, but you, O Lord, are a shield around me. All right, a couple other points of interest about this psalm, and these will come into play again with other psalms that we'll be looking at in the coming weeks. Psalm 3 is the first one that includes a heading, and that heading has two parts. The first part reads, A Psalm of David. And we'll discuss we'll save that discussion actually for next week, because we find the same phrase in Psalm 4 and we'll have more time to address it then. The second part of the heading reads, When he fled from Absalom his son. And this is actually the first of 14 psalms that includes some note in the title that connects it to an actual event. We don't have a lot of those, but of the 150, there are 14 that do. And so this would give Psalm 3 in particular a historical context. Namely, the situation described in 2 Samuel 15 and 16. And this would be, of course, a very low moment in David's life. You might recall the setting there. Because of his sin with Bathsheba, all sorts of things were unraveling. Not only did David have troubles in his own home, but his kingdom had been pulled away from his grasp by Absalom's rebellion. And David was forced, of course, to flee from Jerusalem, and he waited things out at a camp across the Jordan. Psalm 3 may have been written the night before a major battle was to be fought. The opposition is very strong and the danger is very real. However, these historical titles are the subject of some debate, and we would have to be a little careful on how far we push them. For instance, we have copies of early manuscripts of the Psalms that do not include these notes. And so there is some reluctance to accept them as part of the original composition. In fact, some versions of the Bible just leave them out altogether. In addition to this, many times they don't seem to line up that well. Psalm 3 is actually a good example of this. At first, the psalm does seem to describe the setting we find in 2 Samuel, but there are some differences that can't be overlooked. In the psalm, David comes across as confident, resolved, you know, at peace. And he prays for his enemies to be crushed. In 2 Samuel, David is, we have a different picture. He is depressed. He is worried. He wants to be sure that no harm would come upon his enemy, you know, who seeks his death. That enemy being, of course, his son Absalom. And we see these sorts of discrepancies with some of the other titles that we find in the Psalms as well. So it is generally believed that these notes at the beginning of a psalm that connect to a historical episode were probably added later, not a whole lot later, but a bit later. And it is something that, you know, people smarter than us make a living at discussing. You know, scholar somewhere work through all this sort of thing. But the bottom line for us is this. It really doesn't matter that much one way or the other. What is amazing about the Psalms is that they were born out of, is that even though they were born out of a particular life experience, their content remarkably seldom includes any reference to the events that brought them into being. Except for perhaps one or two, they are not situation specific. They were not written that way. And if each psalm were tightly connected to a specific historical event, then it would no doubt inhibit its wider use among God's people. Again, these psalms, I mean, they really are a gift from God to us. They speak for us. Regardless of what we are going through, there are a number of different ones we can always connect with. Now, this could be illustrated quite easily with the popular hymn, "It Is Well With My Soul," written by Horatio Spafford. We've talked about the history of this a number of times. You may remember the historical context that prompted Spafford to write this hymn. A series of traumatic events. The Great Chicago Fire of 1871 ruined him financially. Then all four of his daughters died when a ship sank in the Atlantic. He later had three more children. One of them, a son, died at the age of four. His church, instead of offering comfort, regarded his tragedies as divine punishment and treated him with disdain. And so though the song "It Is Well" was born out of such hardships, it was written in such a way that anyone can sing it without having experienced the exact same ones that he did. Had Spafford included references to those hardships, you know, in the various verses, well, the song, you know, we wouldn't be singing it. It would have been forgotten long by now. It has a universal application, as does Psalm 3, and for that matter, almost all the Psalms. They are prayers and songs that we privately and corporately can sing, pray, refer to, find comfort in, identify with, and make use of as the situation necessitates. So upon that note, why don't we go ahead and open the doors? We'll let the children come in. Let's stand together. Musicians can come forward. And next week, we'll look at Psalm 4. And it's certainly okay if you want to read ahead. In fact, I might even start off with a quiz. Who knows? But I'd like for us to read Psalm 3 together out loud. So please stand. We just follow along with the ESV here on the screen behind me. And Andrew, if you want to make sure that it gets advanced at the right time. All right, let's read together. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people.